Rusty Quill presents Below Decks, a thrice forgotten deep dive. Episode 10, Writers Round Table.
Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome to what is for now our final episode of Below Decks, where we dig into some of the research, questions, stories, and generally tangential, interesting things that went into making Thrice Forgotten. I'm Raf, my pronouns are she, they, and I'm the director of the series, as well as one of the writers. So by now you will have listened to the entire series, and if you haven't, it's probably worth doing that before you listen to this episode because we are going to spoil everything. I'm so pleased to have with us today our wonderful guest, Morgan Givens, as well as Nemo. Morgan, could you introduce yourself with your relationship to the show and your pronouns?
Sure. My name is Morgan Givens. I am one of the writers on the show, and my pronouns are he, him.
And Nemo, would you like to say hello?
Hi, it's me again, Nemo. I say them pronouns.
And the reason that we have Morgan with us today, as well as the pleasure of his company, is we are going to round out Below Decks by doing a little bit of a writer's round table, where we talk about the process of the show coming together, what it was like to break the story for this season, creating the show bible, and just generally all of that behind the scenes magic that I know everyone loves. So I'm going to kick off with asking Nemo and Morgan some questions, because the show began with them. So I'm going to give you the broadest possible question to start with. How did this happen? Why are we here?
Serendipity.
Yeah. It's quite a funny one, because I was working on it for quite a while by myself, in that I pitched it and then kind of was thinking about loads of things, and then at a certain point Rusty Quill were like, oh, you need to write a bible, a show bible, so that when you bring other people on, they'll be able to understand what the show is. And I had never written one before and had already begun talking with Morgan by then, I believe.
Yeah, I came on right. Yeah. I think that was a show bible. With all your dexterity and the D&D, yes.
Yeah. And Morgan was essentially just download everything that's in your brain onto a piece of paper. And I was like, okay, I could do that.
For those who've never heard the term show bible before, what does that mean?
It's like a really cool template that says things like what the tone of the show is, shows that are a comparison for it, a debrief of all of the characters, of the plot, the episodes, what the audio atmosphere is, some other things about marketing. But it's essentially a huge document so that anyone who's working on the show can find any information that they want about the show in it. For me, I was writing it in a way that, because I knew I was going to have other writers working on it, that you two could read this document, and if you had a question what would this character do in this situation, that you could scroll to their little area and be like, oh, right, okay, here's a little bit of their voice and here's a little bit of their desires in the world. Hopefully it worked out. I mean, you guys worked very well, so it seems like it was okay.
No, I think it was far more than okay. It was really cool. Like Nemo said, I was whatever is in your head, let's get it on this paper, you know? And then I kind of view the show bibles as the rough draft of the story, and then you're able to start chiseling it. But the thing is, Nemo had all these great characters and this great story in their head, and it was okay, now we're going to work together to chisel and refine. And it was more so about listening to what Nemo had to say about what the story was and who the characters are, and then working with them to make it as sharp as we could before we were able to bring on Rafaela, who found all the little plot holes that we had missed, questions about characters, because at a certain point you become so into it. It's always great to have another set of eyes, very creatively, to come in and be like, this is really cool, but why on earth would they do that? And we're like, we don't know. We should figure that out. It's like building the background of these characters. And a lot of stuff in the show bible never makes it into the show, but it allows us to create the depth for the world and who these people are, so that when they do things, there's a sense of real motivation behind it. Even if you don't have the full history of these characters, we're able to write the dialogue, real dialogue, because we knew who they were. I was able to learn who they were by working with Nemo. And then, you know, it was nice to add little different things to them, like Alestes being a foodie. I'm like, yes, you know, so that's when you get to like put the decorations up. I think once you have the show Bible, you get to decorate it, if that makes sense.
Someone who kind of came into the show later, so the show Bible was my onboard point into the series. I'd say a very successful document. It also shouldn't surprise anyone to hear at this point that, as well as all of the things that Nemo listed that you would normally find in a show Bible, there was a PhD's worth of research. So many links to so many YouTube videos and websites and like book citations. So much. I think that was the thing I felt most daunted by when I came. Well, I was like, oh god, am I gonna have to read all of this?
Yeah, at one point someone was like, hey, could you make like a shorter version of the literary document? Yeah, I was like, yeah, okay, I can do that. And it still came out to like 20k, and I was like, interesting.
it worked out, it's fine.
Right, and you also, Nemo, provided, I think, a Pinterest board as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously we're working in audio medium, but getting us all onto the same page visually was something I found incredibly helpful coming into the series.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I found it helpful because at least I realized I'm a much more visual person than I realized. And I'm like, oh, duh, you love to read. Of course, that's a visual medium. It combined with the story Bible helped me figure out the tone of their voices, the way they might carry themselves, like seeing them all in that group picture at the top of this document that Nemo had. Like, I was like, this is like the pirate family. And then you can start seeing some of those dynamics. You can start imagining those dynamics into those characters, which I think for me, as someone who did not have them in my mind, I could not see them in the way because I was not their creator, allowed me, I think, a glimpse into that, which I hope made it so that once they were starting to be written, again, they sounded like the essence of what Nemo had in mind for them, and also like full people. Cause I'm like, dang, look at them. Like, especially Siva. And I'm like, they all like posing. It was like, I want to join, like, let me in, you know? So
yeah, I did draw a little like character lineup because I was like, I need to make sure that everyone understands that Noor is big. Like, that's most of the reason why I drew it. I was like, Noor is like head and shoulders above everyone else, and everyone needs to visually understand that.
Everyone needs to respect Noor.
That's right. Yeah.
And Nemo, you also, I think, drew the ship as well. Yeah. That was something I found incredibly useful because, see, when you're working on audio, the sort of spatial distances between things, proximity, incredibly useful when it came to directing the series as well, because things like, okay, well, if this scene takes place in Alestes' cabin, where is that? So how much can you hear the waves in the background? How audible are other members of the crew as they kind of go about their business? So having Nemo's sort of diagram of the ship and where everything is placed is really important, but also in terms of things like the crew, they have their own cubicles in the lower deck, but they're just separated by probably just fabric or something very thin. So, you know, even knowing that this is a space where everyone's on top of each other all the time, and there isn't really privacy. This isn't like a luxury kind of steamer where you have your own cabin. That changes the dynamic in another way as well. So all of that stuff in the Bible then feeds back into how you write the world and how the characters move in the world.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those things when I was first looking at ships, and I made that diagram to understand how the ship would be layered up from a skeleton kind of view. And yeah, space is something that I just couldn't wrap my head around because I'm also very visual, and was like, I just don't have any concept. I watched loads of YouTube videos of people like giving their yacht tours, and I think the Netawansan is like closer in size to a large yacht than like, I guess, a lot of the sail ships. You know, the like kind of period dramas, men on ships kind of thing. They're on very big like British imperial vessels, and that's not what the Netawansan is. It's a quite condensed ship, and so kind of understanding how small everything would be and how, yeah, on top of each other they would be. And they're all like collectors, right? And I remember writing that into the Bible, which is that like, once they start bringing stuff onto the ship, it's going to be a fight over, like, me or the stingrays. and, yeah, I just thought that that was a good way to remember, even though it doesn't, I don't think it really comes into play so much in season one, a good thing to remember is that, like, they are people who've just met each other. They're not going to immediately know how to live with each other, and they will be tense because of it.
Yeah. We know that downstairs, the downstairs of the ship, I've picked up so much nautical language during the series.
Hey, below decks.
The name of this show. We know that below deck in the ship, they're starting to vie for space. We know that there's, obviously we've got our aquarium down there, and we know that Inez is building a bit of a laboratory down there, as we find out in episode 10, and explosives laboratory, and armory.
Yeah, I'm very excited, like, because I do think that they have a little corner in the ship, which is literally just behind curtains, and everyone respects Inez's privacy enough that they fully have just been, like, stealing gunpowder from places and have a whole, like, weapons table lined up. Baker's like, you know, I'm not gonna, like, sneak in, look at anything. And now I'm sure Baker's probably like, God, I wish I had, like, an elf on a shelf.
Oh my God. Yo, season two, you've got to have some allusion to, like, Baker being like, don't let Inez behind the curtain alone.
Actually, I wanted to ask a question. I'm going to take us back a little bit in the timeline, because, Nima, you talked on previous episodes about how this was started as much more of a food-based story. So I wonder, what was the germ of this? The characters, or the piracy, or the sort of colonial critique? Where did it begin?
Good question. So it came through a couple of different things, which was because I was working at the Natural History Museum and I was looking at all these fish all the time. And I believe this fun fact I've already said, that I was looking at this jar and it said Alestes on it, because that is a type of fish. I was thinking about collections, and I was thinking about a vehicle to talk about exploration and travel, and I thought that food would be a great way into that. I have to say, quite, because I really liked anime, like One Piece and Toriko, which are like adventure shows where they do go to places and they eat food, and that is a big, like, aspect of it. And I thought, but one thing that they don't really talk about in those is, like, how food links up to colonization and imperial expansion. And as we've seen in episode 8, tea is where that kind of lies, I guess, like, it calcified a bit, in that tea was brought by the British to India and South Asia from China on plantations. So the idea of Alestes, and to an extent Baker, being interested in food is the kind of remnant of that, in that they are the kind of people who are able to travel between places and eat new food. I mean, you know, that's not something that a lot of people could do at the time. And even though I wouldn't say that either of them are privileged people, they do have the privilege of trying new foods in different places. And I thought that that would be a fun way to give us story arc. And then everyone was like, you should actually talk about the colonization and the museum stuff. And I was like, oh yes, that is probably the bigger story here than the food. So the food gets to be the fun stuff.
And were they always pirates? Was it always a pirate story in your head?
They were always merchants, I think. And other people would make them pirates. And the fact that they can't exist as, like, nautical merchants, the fact that they have to survive doing criminal activity, or, like, what people see as criminal activity, I think, yeah, that's where the change became.
It's just, I find that so interesting, because see, whenever I'm telling people about the podcast, I'm like, oh yeah, it's a queer pirate adventure. This is what I go to first. And again, I don't want to kind of retread too much stuff, but Nima, you've talked before about your kind of love for the nautical epic, but also the slightly queasy relationship with it. And that was it the way that it was sold to me, how I came on board with this project? Because as you've said, Nemo and Morgan, you'd already been working on this for some time. I was writing for Cry Havoc, which is yet to come out. And April, our executive producer, messaged me and said, hey, do you like pirates?
Why does that sound like the email that I got from April that was like, what would you think about working on a pirate show? And I was like, who are you? Hello, lovely to meet you. What?
But, you know, it's fun to think of the show and instructive to think of the show as in the pirate genre, because I think that's the thing that alerts you to so many of the differences between this story that we're telling and, you know, what and who usually occupies the foreground in a pirate epic. And, yeah, as soon as you sort of go into, well, what if these characters are forced into, you know, being on the, you know, the quote-unquote the wrong side of the law, kind of through necessity, that then I think it's a much more interesting way of exploring the kind of the moral side of pirating, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. It feels like it has a lot of parallels, I think, to the things that people go through today, you know, because I can at least speak to the United States, you know, they'll criminalize behavior. And it's like, but you're saying this is criminal behavior, but maybe if you actually gave people the food they needed, because there's no reason that people shouldn't have food. Like, it's a lot of times they'll look at the action without viewing the entire picture or the intent behind the action and just be like, oh, you're a bad person, when it's really about maintaining power over these people who have, quote unquote, less than by design. And so it was really interesting for me to see these people attempting to get out from underneath the yoke of, like, this life, and then constantly kind of getting pulled back in by the forces from their past. You know, Alestis is trying, you know, this whole, it's her trying to escape so many different forces from her past, physical and mental, and constantly just those tendrils kind of keep coming back and grabbing her almost by the ankle and slowing her down, pulling her back. And I see that with a lot of folks, you know, with our prison system. I mean, there's that parallel is for sure there when we think about recidivism and incarceration. It's almost like she's incarcerated in her past, and every time she tries to get out, it's like, hey, row your boat, you know? And it's like, I don't want to do that. That was one of the ways it kind of resonated, at least with me, while writing. I'm like, you know, just tonally, thematically, I'm like, I feel like there are a lot of folks who are marginalized by society and aren't marginalized by any means, who could kind of, if it's not immediately recognizable, can feel that. I mean, at least I felt it while writing, which was dope, you know, in a sad way, but dope.
Yeah.
The capitalism side of the equation as well resonated with me, in terms of, you know, we know what Alestis wants, which is a big pile of money and a nice beach. And she's been set up to fail by the system that she's in. There's no way she's going to achieve the life that she wants, you know, legally, kind of by going through the, you know, just go through the proper channels, which is a very that's a very UK bit of racism.
Like Alestis at the beginning of the show, they are starving, you know, and she's trying really, really hard not to steal from people, and it is that decision in episode 6 ? Where she tries really hard to haggle, but there is just no money, because any trade that she's been doing, she is disadvantaged in. And Gammon, as we find out, has had this chokehold on markets. He's like a very successful pirate. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is like making sure that nobody can succeed without his saying so, and like able to keep people from succeeding. And that is what he is doing. So I've been so excited, like, to be able to talk about Gammon / Graham, obviously, because he's like at the end and he is kind of the big boss, but also like, oh my God, he's such a piss baby. There's more people kicking him while he's down.
But isn't that how it always is? It's always the biggest, blusteriest folks. And like, you just poke them a little bit, they'd be like, like a balloon, just, you know? People like Gammon are puffy because they're not actually puffy, you know? That's what we say here, like, oh, you getting puffy, like you swelling up. And he walks around constantly swole up, but it's like, you're threatening to the folks who have yet to be able to see you for who you are, at least is how I kind of saw it. And then once Alestis, from my view, once she started seeing him for what he was, that was a threat to him as well. But he's so nasty, he couldn't let her go, you know?
Desperate to, like, keep the only person who, like, still saw him as anything good or positive. And, well, if I can't have her be thinking of me as positive, then she will still think of me. Mm-hmm. Gross,
but
man.
You have heard of me. Loved writing Gammon / Graham because all of those things are absolutely true and at the heart of him, but he also has to be an effective villain, because I think very often you end up defining the central kind of concern of a series through its antagonist. Like, they end up kind of embodying the kind of bigger existential forces that you're kind of fighting against. And it was so fun to write the flashbacks to Alestis' past with Gammon and write that kind of slightly queasy parental relationship that's going on. And then, of course, write everything that comes after that as very heavily, I think, modeled on like an estranged parent-child relationship of, like, you know, you can't pretend that the relationship never existed. And it's this specter that kind of haunts all of their conversations. And so, you know, it's real when Alestis digs up the treasure and kind of finds the note from Gammon, oh, better luck next time. That's a real betrayal. So that's giving it emotional stakes as well as, obviously, Gammon is representing a lot of political forces that are antagonistic. Yeah, I so enjoyed writing
that was great
episodes.
Like, the scripts were so cool. And my question, I was wondering if for like the two of you, was, is that the first time that in y'all's minds or within the show that he kind of turned his cruelty on Alestis in a way that perhaps he hadn't before? Because yeah, that's just interesting that would be like the thing for her that is like, I can't do this with you no more, for it to have been like the treasure, for that to have been such a big thing. But I guess I was just wondering about how that would have landed for her, if like internally.
I think it's up for interpretation in the, you know, we don't see a lot of Alestis and Gammon's past together. So you are kind of allowed to infer in the gap. And I think this is sort of my personal kind of canon about it. This is the place that I was writing from was, you know, it's quite possible that Gammon has kind of been casually cruel to Alestis because that's sort of who he is as a person. But also, he holds her up to feel so special, which is such a powerful thing, especially, I think, you know, when you're at quite a formative age, which we know that she was when she joined the crew. And it's such a calculated bit of cruelty when he sort of betrays her with the treasure hunt and the turtles, because it's harking back to what I think was a meaningful moment for, you know, in the past, this kind of moment of just the two of them on a treasure hunt. He's asking her about, you know, what do you really want? Like, he's kind of, that's the beginning of him being like, oh, she's going to be my heir. And kind of, you know, she's sort of my daughter that I never had. And then to take that moment and use it to just kick her when she's down. I think, yeah, it's a very deliberate bit of cruelty. And I don't know, this is maybe where I get more kind of, this is my headcanon. I don't know how much Gammon would have thought that through as to how it would land on her. Like, I don't think he's like a master chess player or anything. I think he's just sort of like, this girl, I'm so pissed at her, I'm gonna, you know, run away from my crew, will you? Well, how about this? Maybe a bit of an attempt to kind of remind of, like, you know, you're not better than me, you belong down in the dirt with me.
I do like as well that, like, this episode with the turtles, I remember at some point someone was like, can we change the turtles to something? And I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, part of it is Alestis being quite desperate about something with a very childlikeness. And I think I've mentioned before that Alestis hasn't been allowed to be a child,
yeah,
like, ever. And, like, has always had to be fighting and always had to be an adult. And the fact that Gammon effectively ruins the one kind of, like, child, like, Alestis is on a pirate treasure hunt with someone who is being really nice to her and is about to, like, share loads of money with her. And she's like, hell yeah, this is like a child's every dream, right? Like, we've got these turtles and they're magic and we're going to take them to the treasure. And we found this huge belt of treasure and it made everyone really like me and it was really cool. And to specifically use that memory against Alestis, I think, was really pivotal when I was reading these scripts and being like, that is the most knife in the back thing that Gammon could do to her, which is take the one good memory of being allowed to be childish and to completely ruin it for her forever.
Yeah, especially knowing he would have known what happened to her as a small person. He would have gotten that, even though, as you said, he's barely playing checkers, you know. But that makes total sense. And I totally understand why you were like, them turtles aren't going. And I was like, all right, bet. Even just hearing you kind of say that, I'm like, I get that. There's that magical, that sense of childishness that, you know, and he ruined it and whatever good memory she had. So, man, Alestis needs a break, man. I just want to, like, yeah, I want to bake her a cake or something, you know, like some cookies, some glazed potatoes. I don't know. Like, she needs something.
Well, we talked in our episode with Sam, our composer, about composing the kind of different bits for different characters. And one of the conversations I had with Sam early on was when it came to Alestis, like, look, there is something deeply childlike that's still within, there is still a spark of that in her as much as well, but that she's never, you're absolutely, Nima, that she's never been allowed to be a child, but holding on to the hope of it. And we see that so much in, you know, she's hearing the song that her father used to sing her and kind of finding the plate. And it's all about, you know, this is a very big, like, hero's journey, Joseph Campbell-esque kind of, like, thing, but kind of so much of characters' journeys often is like trying to find a route back to childhood, which kind of never really existed in the first place for her, which is really devastating. But, like, you know, even her thing of like, I want to retire on a beach with a big pile of money, like, again, that's like what a 10-year-old wants. Yeah.
That's true. It's like she got arrested where things began to go terribly wrong, you know, because that's what trauma does. It kind of arrests part of you, you know, and you continue to grow, but then you build all these defenses to protect that little traumatized part. It's like she just kept getting parts of her internally arrested. And I think, yeah, that's those parts come out, you know, despite her attempting to act like she has a hard edge.
And every time she tries to trust someone or like allows herself to trust someone, eventually miscommunications happen and it takes her back two steps again.
Yeah.
And,
well, while we're talking about traumatized characters, I was going to ask you about Siva next. Especially because, Nima, you said that Siva was maybe the first character that you kind of conceived, or the second character maybe, but like very early. So he's really intrinsic to kind of the heart of the show. So yeah, tell us about Siva and where he came from.
Siva comes from, I think, as you said, in the show Bible, there is a PhD level of research. And I've said this in quite a few things, in that I have this love-hate relationship with finding out about information. And I think that Siva came from that, like, desperately wanting to impress people that he should not have to impress. And their, like, interpretations of him, like, the more intelligent he can seem and the better his maps are and the more research that he can do, he can grow in, like, people's estimation, or like he just, like, has that, like, hierarchy in his head where he's like, this is what I'm reaching for, Queen's Museum, gonna get there, and like that's not even what everyone wants from me, just like that is where I should be aiming for, because that is the ultimate of knowledge and experience and coolness. And yeah, I think that Siva came from
it sucks there. To realize in some ways when people kind of take advantage, I think, again, of the innocence of children and start to mold them in that way, and that's kind of what that does when they, because they're like, they're trying to put boxes and constraints on the possibilities we have for ourselves. And so it's, you know, looking at Siva even throughout the show, it's like he's pushing towards these boxes that they put to, you know, and he's pushing towards the edge of this, while also it seems like he doesn't even realize he's also kind of simultaneously starting to dismantle that. And it internally, I can sense some of that. I could at least sense him starting to begin, even if he didn't realize he was questioning it, to question it.
I, like, even though Nani actually was kind of like hinting at those things, didn't have the confidence to be like, to fully say out loud what she wanted to say. Mm-hmm. And you see like hints of her being like, you shouldn't trust them so much, but also she's not in a great situation herself. Right. And I think there was a weighing up for her with like, well, maybe he can kind of quote unquote get out. Mm-hmm. Or like make some money or make his life more than it could be here, where yeah, there's loads of stuff in, mm-hmm. in that as well, and like the belief in the imperial system. But at this point in time, like Siva like possibly did have an opportunity to not live in poverty his entire life by subscribing to these things, but that through the series he has people now like Alestes and Baker and Inez and Noor not telling him what to do, but to give him the fuller context of why people are saying these things to him, and he can go to them and ask for advice. And even his, like, you know, autistic realization in episode 7 and 8, where Baker is like, people aren't saying what they truly mm-hmm. mean to you. And he has to be like, oh, right, okay, that's weird. Why wouldn't they?
Like, why wouldn't you say what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And all of those kind of things. And yeah, I think he was a good vehicle for the screwed up nature of how it's still happening mm-hmm. in the 21st century.
Yeah. And he and Alessi's are situationally the same, right? Because they're completely opposed in temperament, but they are displaced children.
Yeah.
Like, they both have parental figures, but they are displaced children. And that's sort of what this system does, of kind of removes you from your roots. And then in the case of Siva, kind of goes, oh, but you could be the special one. Like you could try and assimilate into whiteness, essentially, into imperialism, and then we'll hold you up as an example to everyone else, to kind of go, you look, you see, it's a very like power protecting itself system that I think is present in both of those characters, which maybe is part of why they're both so central.
Yeah.
Even though temperamentally poles apart.
But yeah, I think they do both see each other in each other, even if they're 100% not aware of it. I'm sure they are not aware of it, but they work together as good season one characters. That is why the focus is mostly on Alestes and Siva in this first season, because they are coming from the same place and they need to get to a similar place. But the way that they've got about it is completely
opposite. I guess that's why Alestes gets so annoyed with him. She's like, if you don't get out of my face reminding me of me.
She's like shudders, like, oh god, that could have been me. I could have been the uncool version of myself.
Siva's cool, okay? Siva is cool. That's not fair to Siva.
Yeah. I wanted to say, like, this is a tangent to something, which is that, like, I think that a lot of people maybe have underestimated how much you, Morgan, and Raph have done on this show as well, because and I basically wanted to highlight how much both of you have done for it, because I for sure needed so much help with, like, Morgan, you had such a great way of conceptualizing audio that was really helpful beginning. And when we were first sort of drafting out the episodes, making outlines, Morgan was there basically being like, but how can we make that into good audio? And I was like, yes, that's a good point. Things like the underwater scene at the beginning with Ndliswa like drowning, and the like cannons or the thunderstorm above, like whatever we hear above, you being there and being like, it needs to be a like statement piece of audio. And I was like, hell yeah. And then Raph coming in after the show Bible had been created, and Morgan and I had made these like outlines together. Raph basically sat down with me at one point and was like, okay, it has so many plot holes and I don't understand it. We need to go through and just, Nemo, you just need to tell me the answer to all of these questions. And I was like,
I would like to just say, I did not phrase it.
No, you said it a lot nicer than that. And I am thankful for that. But that is basically what it was. And I openly admit mm-hmm. that it was like me being like, oh God, I don't know.
That's why writer's rooms are important.
No, but honestly, it felt like I got the easy job of kind of coming in and being the, being sort of fresh pair of eyes and just sort of going, because what was so apparent is, you know, the world is so rich. Like I said, the show Bible is this massive, impressive, like brilliant document, and the outlines were so detailed. So I feel like I came in at a stage where it was like, these are all the pieces that we have on the table, and there's loads of them, and they're all great. So it was kind of, and there were things I think through those conversations that we ended up going, you know, okay, maybe we don't have room for that in this season. Maybe we'll put that aside for the future, or kind of actually we don't have to tell all of our stories at once. You know, we can sort of keep our powder dry on some of this. And also just, you know, the plot of Gammon is Graham, Graham is Gammon, and like, where does Nanny fit into all of this? And kind of, you know, it's a complex political thriller that you've created. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of a spy story. You know, Alessi's becomes a bit of a detective in episode 8. So I was also thinking, yeah, just putting my genre goggles on and kind of going, how do we make this the most entertaining possible thriller, adventure, spy story, as well as it being already a very fun science pirate story? I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to make science pirates a thing.
Yeah. Science pirates.
I believe it.
And it was like really, it was really cool working with you two on this, because I essentially, like, before doing this show, had only been in like a couple of writers' rooms before and had never show run or like been the lead writer and things. So definitely listened to podcasts which were like, how to be a showrunner. And I was like, oh. And the two pieces of advice that I definitely was like the most in my brain about was like, treat other people how you want to be treated, which is just a good way of doing it in life, and to be quite decisive about things and just make sure you know what you're being decisive about, but then allowing the writers to have flexibility when it's their episodes.
I learned just about the writing process, because the episode outlines that you provided were massively helpful, but then you were also very generous about kind of being like, very non-precious and kind of going like, but you know, but do what you want. And what I found was, you know, when you're writing essentially a 20-minute episode, you can't always fit in a C story in that time. So it's sort of, what do we have room for? How is our A and B story going to? So these are really like basic writing things, so I apologize for this, but kind of how are our A and B story going to interact, if they do at all? And if they don't interact, are they going to thematically complement each other? Which, again, you know, all of these, none of these are rules. All of these things can be played around with. I remember one of the things I was most worried about writing the treasure hunt episode, because we also just knew, like, also this is the episode where we need to find out about Baker's backstory, and that was one of the things I was like, how am I going to tie together what is happening with Alestes and Inez on the island, and what is happening with you know, why do we get to find out the Baker backstory? And I think, Nima, you'd already suggested kind of, well, you know, Siva leaves the island, comes back, and it's Siva having a conversation with Baker. But again, I was like, how do we tie together these? Well, so essentially, we've got the two main relationships of the episode are Alestes and Gammon and Baker and Gabe. And neither of those relationships are in the present tense. Neither of them are happening, like, in the same sense. But in the end, and this is something I'm going to ask both of you as well, in the end, I think that's my favorite episode of the three that I wrote. So that makes it sound like I was going to ask you, what's your favorite episode of the ones that I wrote? Not what I was going to ask.
All of them.
No, what I want to ask both of you is, what is the thing that you enjoyed writing the most in the series? Because for me, it's the Baker and Gabe scenes, which I wasn't expecting, but they just flew onto the page. They were just, you know.
So isn't it magic when that happens? And you're like, I don't know why, but I'm going to run with it. Oh gosh, my favorite.
Yeah.
See, I don't know if I have a favorite. I ended up with the episodes, I think, with a lot of random humor. I don't know. I really liked the Siva trying to find the rays. You know, that scene where we can hear them in the water, and then we kind of go back to Alestes and Baker talking, and then we hear them. And it was actually Nemo's idea to combine that a bit more, than initially so that we could make that scene feel larger, as though they're literally on the edge or somewhere on that ship watching. You can hear these clowns in the background. And Nemo was like, no, we need to hear them. And I was like, you're right. They're in the same space. And so I really love that.
A nightmare to direct and sound.
Sorry,
so
but
thank
it's,
you both.
Y'all, look, when I listened to it, no, I was like, right, oh my God. Right. I was like, I can hear. I was like, yes. You all
right,
like really, because it is so hard, I think, especially for folks who are learning to write into audio, because it's writing is writing, but there's just like little things that you do kind of differently when you're writing audio primarily or audio forward.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, this is going to be a nightmare scene. But I was like, I can hear the sound design. I can hear that sense of movement. I can hear that shifting back and forth. And so I really enjoyed that just because it made me laugh, especially when they come back up on there and like they've got it, you know, and they're like looking. I think it was just the moments of random bonding, you know, without them perhaps realizing that they were bonding. It was like team building while laughing and you trying to catch rays. And I really like, this is a cheat, but I love the fact that Alestis wanted to row that boat, you know, and that cracked me up. And it still cracks me up because, you know, I'm right. I'm like, you think you're going to row a boat, you know?
So, you're like holding a knife up. My favorite thing is like, yeah, the like cat with knife or like crab with knife, just being like,
just like chasing after you. Yeah, so I guess they're like kind of my favorites. Right.
That catching stingray scene, a quick sidebar, is a really good example of, again, the beauty of a writer's room, because to make that work and to get the kind of the size and the scale of that, when I was doing my kind of preparation for recording, I remember looking at that scene and going like, okay, we have to establish these two different locations super clearly because they're in the same space, but they're right. Not in the same space, and we're going to be cutting back and forth. So I ended up, I think like on the fly, almost in the recording session, just scribble down a couple of extra lines to just kind of slide in, just to plant it. Because this is also something I've found with audio, is you can get away with being more explicit about kind of where you are than you need to be on screen. Because, you know, your listeners are kind of primed for, you know, a character walk in and go, ah, oh, well, here we are in my granddad's old shed. And like, not as boldly quite as that, but perhaps. But like, that was, I would say, a collaborative effort. Nemo, this is almost an impossible question.
Yeah, I was trying
to
like narrow it down, but I feel like because I have the luxury of now talking about episodes 9 and 10, I do think that I really enjoyed writing Gammon's like cricket scene, where there's like the cricket in the background and he's also like being a piece of crap to Siva, and Siva is trying to like, haha, yes, I'm a servant, haha. And also all of the scenes with Mary, I found I really enjoyed writing her. She's a character that I have fleshed out quite a lot. Her kidnapping Siva every time they are together, I am really like cat with knife, just being like, Siva, how are you gonna get out of this one?
Siva got kidnapped again. I laughed so hard, and I was like, okay.
I have to say, like, at the beginning, Siva did not get kidnapped this much, but every time that Morgan and I would have a conversation, Morgan would react like that, and I'd be like, I'm gonna make Siva be kidnapped again. So it's Morgan's fault that Siva gets kidnapped so much, because I just
so
have so much
funny.
Joy.
Like, at a certain point, you're just like, oh, this is the joke. Like, the joke is you are always getting kidnapped.
I mean, there are some characters who are just so good for you, like, ah, we need to show peril. We're gonna put this character in danger. As we're going to have to wrap this up, any final thoughts?
No, I had a blast in the writer's room. It was a lot of fun to just be creative with like other fun, creative folks, and like, you know, to be trusted with something that you created, Nemo, as well, because I think we're all creative people here. We've all made our own things, and it can be hard to allow others to partake in something that you've created and to give that freedom that, you know, you did allow us to have. You know, there were moments where you're like, nope. But that's your job as like the lead writer, as the person who knows this story. But you did give us a fair amount of freedom within those episodes to bring our voice to the episode while keeping it sounding like what Trice Forgotten was starting to sound like. So no, I mean, I enjoyed working with both of you. I learned a lot working with both of you. And like, you need a writer for season 2, you know where to find me.
Yeah, similar. I mean, this Below Decks has always been just a love fest, but the ability to have writers come in and fully understand who these characters are and to basically, yeah, please write me some things. And I got to have the content delivered to my desk and was like, really talented people are writing things that I want to see or listen to. So
you were the sicko.
Yes.
They're like, yes.
And we got to talk about really cool things. And I don't think that we talked in Below Decks about disability yet, but we talked a bit about autism, but like physical disability is something that hopefully we can explore more in season two and all of these kind of things that like the pirate genre, the nautical genre is full of. And hopefully we've been able to talk about them in a way that we're all coming from a like more lived experience perspective, and a way that like hopefully people see themselves in. And yeah, I've been having a blast getting like messages from people who are just like really loving your guys' work and your episodes, and yeah, the writing and the humor and love fest. I love this show. and I love everyone who's worked on it. So
I love you too. I'm going to ask one more question before we wrap up, which is on our crew, you know, everyone kind of has a particular skill, a very special set of skills. So I want to ask you, if you're on Alesti's crew, what are you bringing to the table? What's your position in the crew? What's your special skill?
Oh, I'm going to have to be the comedic bard. Like, they're just going to have to. I'm going to be like, look, Alessis, if you feed me, I'll make you laugh. I'll make others laugh, and we'll get paid. I'm just going to be the pirate comedian. You put me on the stage. I don't know. Whatever. That I think, is what I'd end up doing. It's just like, I'm there for the chuckles. I'm the guy. They're like, we don't know how you got here, why you're still here, but you're funny, so cool, you know? Like the jocks are, I don't know if y'all watch Xena, you know, I don't know, but jocks are would always show up randomly and they were like, why are you here? And he's like, comedic relief, you know, so I'm jocks.
I mean, yeah, you've done that perfectly for the show already. So I think that I would attempt to convince Alesti's that PhDs are totally marketable and that she should definitely give me like 3 gold coins to do loads of research, and I will 100% have like 3 books to sell and loads of people will buy them. 100%, loads of people will buy them. Raf?
Yeah, what about you?
Oh, okay. Well, I am a white femme person. So, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm Italian and Jewish, so I'm a bit of a spicy white. But, like, what doesn't mean, like, definitely white enough, I think, that maybe I could be their, like, weaponized Karen.
Oh,
yes. 100%. Man. Yeah.
Yes. Next time Mary shows up, y'all get wrapped.
A defensive white, quick.
You gotta get our Karen. That is brilliant. Go get our spicy white, y'all. We need her.
Yeah. I do think, like, I think that we could definitely have you kind of be the first person to step off the ship to talk to all of the, like, import-export people and just shed a little bit of a tear and be like, oh, it was so hard to see as a femme.
So terrible. And then everybody else comes off the boat after you've gotten all the paper. They're like, no, wait a minute. Too late now.
Too late, you signed it. Wait.
What a great way to end.
Oh, great. So we will wrap up there. Before we go, Morgan, where can we find you? And do you have anything to plug?
You can listen to my podcast, Flies Fables. It's a fiction podcast. Season
so
two.
Good.
Thank you. Season two finishes, you know, end of this year, starting in about 2 weeks. Don't know when this is airing. So I'll say season two finishes this year. And you can find me on Twitter, if I stay there, at Optimus_Mo. Like the Transformers.
Amazing. Nemo, where can we find you? And do you have anything to plug?
You can find me as ever on Twitter or on Tumblr. You can send me asks on Tumblr at Zeus_Japonicus. And I don't know, you can hopefully make my PhD marketable at some point. I'm finishing it and I've got to sell books, so one day you should buy them.
I will actually buy one of those books.
Thank you.
You can find me,
Raf, where can people find you?
On Twitter at Rafaela Marcus. I have nothing to plug at the moment. That's very nice. I'm back to my desk. I'm back to writing at the moment. So maybe there'll be things in the future. So for now, it has been such a pleasure sharing these behind the scenes context episodes with all of you gorgeous listeners, spiritually blessed. Your skin is clear. So your crops beautiful. Are flourishing, as are ours. So we'll join me in saying goodbye to our listeners for the last time for the moment. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thrice Forgotten is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. The series is created by Nemo Martin and directed by Rafaela Marcus and was edited by Laurie Ann Davis and Catherine Ranella. Thrice Forgotten is produced by Ian Gears, Laurie Ann Davis, and production manager Natasha Johnston, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner. To subscribe, view associated materials, or join our Patreon, visit rustyquill.com. Rate and review us online. Tweet us at @TheRustyQuill. Visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.